It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Kenya responds to last week's school massacre with airstrikes in Somalia. Kenyan warplanes Sunday and Monday launched attacks on two al-Shabaab camps in Somalia following the militant-claimed massacre of a northeast Kenyan school that left nearly 150 dead Thursday. A Kenyan defense spokesman said the camps were destroyed. White House spokesman Josh Earnest was asked if the U.S. was involved.
I can tell you that the United States is working closely with Kenya to support their efforts to both investigate the terrible act of terrorism that we saw at the end of last week, but also to help them prepare a response in a way that better secures their country.
Speaking Monday with VOA, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed urged Kenya to avoid drastic measures in its effort to halt al-Shabaab attacks. He objected to calls by some Kenyan politicians to deport all Somali refugees or build a wall along the Kenyan-Somali border. Fierce clashes raged in southern Yemen between Shia Houthi rebels and forces loyal to the country's president. Witnesses say a foreign warship shelled targets in and around Aden, while Saudi-led coalition airstrikes hit an airbase north of Aden and targets in the capital, Sana'a. Medical sources say more than 50 have been killed in the past 24 hours. Hundreds of foreigners were able to evacuate by ship Monday, including this Indian national.
The Yemen was very beautiful. We love the Yemen. Because there is some problem here, we are going to leave Yemen. Inshallah, we'll come back within 2-3 months. Everything is okay. We are very happy in Yemen. Exactly, we don't have any problem. Our management was handling very good. Still now, we are very happy as going to India.
Chinese, Pakistani, and Sri Lankan nationals were also able to leave Monday. A Russian plane evacuated nearly 160 people. This is VOA News. The UN Security Council Monday called for evacuation and protection of thousands of Palestinian refugees trapped in a camp under siege by Islamic State fighters near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Dinar Kawar is Jordan's UN ambassador and current Security Council president.
The members condemned in the strongest terms the grave crimes committed by Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra against 18,000 civilians in the camp and emphasized the need that such crimes do not go unpunished. The members called for the protection of civilians in the camp, for ensuring humanitarian access to the area, including by providing life-saving assistance, and ensure safe passage and evacuation of the civilians.
Palestinian Ambassador Riyad Mansour pleaded with the parties fighting in Syria not to drag Palestinian civilians into the civil war. Facing strong criticism of the framework nuclear agreement with Iran, President Obama continues to promote its effectiveness in reining in Tehran's nuclear ambitions. His Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, who took part in the Swiss negotiations and is a nuclear physicist, met with reporters at the White House Monday describing the constraints on Iran as longstanding.
This is not an agreement for 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. It is a long-term agreement with a whole set of phases. And if Iran earns over this time period trust and confidence in their peaceful objectives, well, then over time, the constraints will, in phases, ease up, but never get lower than the additional protocol and all of the access that it provides. So that's the way we think about it. It's not a fixed-year agreement. It's a forever agreement, in a certain sense, with different stages.
Meanwhile, President Obama Monday said he would continue working with U.S. partners to address what he called Iran's destabilizing activities in the Middle East. Speaking by phone with the Sultan of Oman, Mr. Obama pledged the next phase of negotiations would ensure the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said his government will work with Kurdish authorities to liberate the northern province of Nineveh from Islamic State militants. Iraq's Kurdistan President Masoud Barzani said both sides have agreed to form a committee of military and security experts to see how the collaboration will work. A report released on the 21st anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda criticized flawed decision-making by the international community for failing to contain the wanton killing in 1994. The report was the work of a multinational conference that took place last year at The Hague, sponsored by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and the Hague Institute for Global Justice. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan warplanes launched attacks on Al-Shabaab targets in Somalia as analysts continue to assess last week's attack on Garissa University.
Every single attack has clearly shown how inadequate Kenya's capacity is and how ill-prepared this country is really to tackle terrorism.
Rashid Abdi is a Kenyan and Horn of Africa analyst. A $2,000 reward is offered for missing Zimbabwe activist Itaya Zamara. Sudanese students in Uganda criticize next week's elections in their country. And Liberia's George Weah may seek the presidency for a third term.
Ambassador Weah is primarily focused on his senatorial portfolio. What he wants to do in the next 1 year, 1.5 years, is to try to change the condition of our people, provide opportunity for them. As we go to 2017, there's a greater possibility that Ambassador Weah could be a candidate.
Nathaniel Fallon-McGee is national chairman of Liberia's main opposition Congress for Democratic Change. Malawi police get orders to shoot people who attack albinos for their body parts. And scientists are developing anti-venom against all African snakes. Those stories plus Mark Olmeyer's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan warplanes have attacked targets in neighboring Somalia days after gunmen from the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab killed 148 people at a Kenyan university. The Kenya Defense Forces say the airstrikes on Sunday targeted two Al-Shabaab camps in Gedo region of southern Somalia. Meanwhile, nearly 17 years since the 1998 terrorist attacks on the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, which killed more than 200 people, some Kenyan citizens and regional security experts say the country has made very little progress in responding to terrorist attacks. Rashid Abdi is a Kenyan and Horn of Africa analyst.
The first thing I would say is that the northeastern province has been insecure in the last 2 years in particular. Conflicts have escalated between the clans, especially in Mandera, as well as in Wajir. And the most serious clan warfare has been between the Dagodia and the Garre. And Al-Shabaab has cleverly exploited these tensions in Wajir and Mandera. And it is now well established that some of the cells that have been conducting these operations, especially in Mandera, were also involved in the clan warfare. Then the second issue to remember is that the province has become increasingly radicalized in the last few years. Youth radicalization has escalated also.
What do you make of the capacity of the security forces to respond to these attacks?
I think, remember a bit of history. The first terror attacks in Kenya, especially in modern times, occurred in 1998. The most large-scale terror attack happened in 1998. And so Kenya has had almost close to two decades to really improve its capacity to respond to attacks of terror. But every single attack has clearly shown how inadequate Kenya's capacity is and how ill-prepared is this country is really to tackle terrorism. Just to give you an example, it took almost 15 hours to bring the siege of the university in Garissa under control. These were only four gunmen. There is also another problem which also I think ought to be highlighted, which is there is a serious rivalry between various agencies in Kenya. Just to give you an example, the Garissa siege was eventually brought under control by a small specialized unit within the General Service Unit, which is called RECI. This is Israeli-trained and U.S.-trained. So they are highly skilled and highly trained. But they are very small, they are ill-resourced, and it took them almost 8 hours to be deployed to Garissa because apparently an aircraft could not be found. So these interagency frictions and rivalries, which we saw also undermined the Westgate operation, I think is also contributing to Kenya's inadequate or slow and sometimes ineffectual response to acts of terrorism.
Apart from the local grievances, is there any particular special that Al-Shabaab did that helped the organization get a foothold in Kenya?
Al-Shabaab is a predator. And like any predator, you don't come to a healthy victim. You basically look for somebody who is weak. And you can see increasingly how Al-Shabaab has tactically exploited grievances in the coast region, grievances in northeastern provinces, which are similar, which are historical marginalization, you know, youth unemployment, poverty, lack of opportunities, and these are communities which basically Al-Shabaab is projecting itself as the champion.
Rashid Abdi is a Kenyan and Horn of Africa analyst. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. The national chairman of Liberia's main opposition, Congress for Democratic Change, the CDC, says there is a strong possibility that party founder and leader George Oppong Weah may consider another run for the presidency in 2017. Weah came second to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in the 2005 and 2011 presidential elections. But Nathaniel Fallow McGee says for now, Weah, who was elected last year as senator of Maserato County, is focused on improving his senatorial portfolio and traveling the country to meet and talk to Liberians about their needs. During a recent visit to the United States with Weah, McGee stopped by our Washington studio and told me they were in the United States to thank the Obama administration for U.S. support during the Ebola crisis in Liberia.
Firstly, Mr. Porter, as you know, during the last 9 to 12 months, our country has been engulfed by Ebola. And as a major political party, we feel it was our responsibility to begin to provide some leadership. We came to the United States firstly to extend our thanks and appreciation to the United States government and also to ask the United States government to find a way to see how we can now begin to address the post-Ebola recovery program. And secondly, we also wanted to find an opportunity to speak to our partisans who are in the U.S.
So while you are here in the United States, you're also meeting with members of the CDC here. How strong is your party?
Well, party is very strong. I've had the opportunity to speak to a lot of Liberians who are sedition. Liberians in the United States have much concern about what is happening back home. They want to see situation improve. They want to have an opportunity to go back home. Liberians want to go back and invest. One of the things I'm hearing from Liberians is that the government is not creating the opportunity, the environment. And during my inauguration, I raised that same issue. Look, when you are in opposition to the government, you're not an enemy. And the government cannot create barriers that only people in government can have the opportunity to invest. And because if we have investment, Mr. Bote, more Liberians will have jobs. But if you limit the possibility for opposition candidates or not Liberians who are not supportive of the regime not to bring investment in the country, then we have a problem on unemployment. Because the government alone cannot employ people. Now you see a lot of Liberians are unemployed. The difficulty is so high in the country. And people are complaining. And the government needs to change its course. And say, look, the country belongs to everyone.
So are you suggesting that investment opportunities are limited to people who sympathize or support the government?
That is correct. Because, Mr. Bote, I know very well, for CEC, for instance, if you went to Liberia and carry any investment in Liberia, there will be no way the government will give you opportunity to invest. I mean, this is a problem. And we have to change that course.
Did I hear that Ambassador George Weah might run for president again?
There's a strong possibility. Ambassador Weah for now, like I said, Ambassador Weah is primarily focused on his senatorial portfolio. What he wants to do in the next 1 year, 1.5 years, is to try to change the condition of our people, provide opportunity for them. He has said, in 90 days, he will find a way to see how he can concentrate on basic health needs of the people, go in the community, provide water. Because sanitation, look, we don't even have safe drinking water. Mr. Bote, sanitation is an issue. And Mr. Weah is primarily focused on that. As we go to 2017, there's a greater possibility that Ambassador Weah could be a candidate.
I mean, your party has been plagued with a lot of, infighting. And there's been this criticism that your party is not, does not have no leadership.
I think that is history. That is the past. The party is very focused as we move forward now. You can see our president in the United States. We have a very strong team of leadership. We have a strong secretary general. We have a strong youth leader. The National Executive Committee is very strong. We're a strong leader, Ambassador Weah himself is in charge. We are not talking about reconciliation. We are reaching out to other political parties to come in. One of the things we've said, Ambassador, we have said at my inauguration on the 20th of July is that one party cannot win an election, meaning the CDC alone cannot do it. We are reaching out to Liberians from diverse backgrounds, irrespective of political persuasion, to come on board. So we are reaching out.
Nathaniel Fallow-McGee is National Chairman of Liberia's main opposition, the Congress for Democratic Change. He spoke with me recently during a visit to our Washington studio. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 7th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The whereabouts of Zimbabwean activist and journalist Itaya Zamara remains a mystery, 1 month after he disappeared at the hands of alleged abductors. Meanwhile, the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition is offering a $2,000 reward to anyone with information on Zamara's whereabouts. Programs manager Nixon Nyikazino says his organization will soon stage public protest to put pressure on the government to look for Mr. Zamara.
We have set up a particular fund whose details will be released this week, whereby we are offering a reward for anyone who has got essential or particular information regarding the whereabouts of Itai Zamara, or anyone who might have knowledge of the rumors around where exactly Itai Zamara could be found. So we've set up in conjunction and in collaboration with other non-governmental organizations. We have got an interest in making sure that Itai Zamara is found alive and healthy.
Why have you decided to take this route?
At times, people are afraid of being victimized when they release particular information that is delicate and sensitive, especially to do with Itai Zamara. And some people might be fearing losing their jobs, losing their lives, and so forth. We felt that it is important for us to put up a fund which can actually motivate those who might be having information to be able to release that particular information. So it's a motivation that we are putting across so that those who have got the information can also benefit eventually from the release of that particular information. The more he is not being found, the more our fears also grow. So we'll motivate further if we do not get any positive result from it.
Nixon Nyikazino is Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition Programs Manager. He was speaking with Jonga Kandimiri of VOA's Zimbabwe Service. Sudanese university students in Uganda have held a meeting to voice their objections to the upcoming April 13th elections in Sudan, where 71-year-old President Omar al-Bashir is running for a fourth term. The students, who are mostly from southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states, say the election will not be inclusive. Bonifacio Taban of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Kampala, Uganda.
Sudanese university student in Kampala organized a meeting to formally reject the April 13 election. And the students are asking for assistance from the international community to help them boycott the boats. 10 of southern of Sudanese civilians have fled to Uganda via South Sudan since 2009 because of the heavy aerial bombardment from the Sudanese army on community in Blue Niles and southern Kordofan. The army said they are fighting the SPLA North and other insurgents in those communities, but many civilians have died in the attacks. Carlo S. Kuma is a Sudanese student studying political science at St. Lawrence University in Kampala. He said the situation in both regions is completely out of control. Kuma blamed the Bashir administration for the unrest and massive displacement of civilians.
We do not want one part of the country to be stable and the other one not to be stable. Once stability has to come, it has to come for the whole country. It has to be comprehensive. But if he takes over the seat, well, these regions are going to suffer. He will continue displacing people internally and people will continue suffering.
The Sudanese students said they do not see a peaceful compromise ever being reached between the warring party in Sudan. Kuma believes the only solution for the Sudanese people is regime change.
The fact that I'm out now of Sudan, I'm studying abroad, I still have hope and vision that one day there will be peace in Sudan, but it is only after this regime is out of Sudan.
In his campaign message last week, President Omar al-Bashir accused the SPLA North of failing to take part in the national dialogue he has been calling for in recent months to help bring about constitutional reform. But rebel group said the president has no intention of reforming the government or the constitution. Sudanese student Mohamed Zain at Kampala University is urging President Bashir to work for the people's interests rather than allow rampant killing by the Sudanese army in Darfur, southern Kordofan, and the Blue Nile state.
Omar Bashir, act like a president. Why do you bombard your citizens? Solve the problem and see. But you don't solve the problems and you kill the population.
A student like Atunia Joseph at Kabene University vowed that should the war continue in his own region's southern Kordofan, youth like him will take up arms against President Bashir and his army.
We are trying to respond to the military. We train ourselves and then we go ahead. It is our Sudan. It is our land that we've been in problem. We don't want to die in. The party was just there. It took power by force. And if you want us to be removed by force, we are ready for that.
For BOA News, I'm Boniface Teban in Kampala.
Malawi police have been given orders to shoot anyone who attacks albinos in order to sell their body parts for witchcraft. Police Chief Lexin Kachaman told his officers to use their weapons in proportion to the gravity of the crime. The Association of Persons with Albinism in Malawi says six albinos have been killed in Malawi since December. Information Minister Kondwani Nakumua says the government is in the process of formulating a policy on the albino crisis.
I have also read the story you are talking about. I saw it in the papers today. But let me point out to say that as government, we have never sat down at any level or even at cabinet to discuss that. That even led to the declaration that the albino, those who be facing albinos will be gunned down.
So if your government hasn't made such a declaration, what does the president think? What does your government think about people killing people for their body parts?
Well, you see, the issue to do with albinos started in Tanzania and tracked down to Malawi. Now, what we have done so far is that we know that Tanzania has tried to somehow contain the situation by applying the appropriate law in the country. Now, we as government have sent a team of our experts, officials that comprise of the both government and non-government organizations to Tanzania to do a study on the matter so that whatever Tanzania was involved in, we would be able to see or to examine if such an issue can be reverted, can be replicated to Malawi, considering the laws governing the Malawi nation.
One would think that this is an urgent, a serious matter for your government, that the president will come out and say something, would make a declaration instead of the police.
As I've said, I'm also surprised. I just got it in the papers. And I cannot explain the reason why.
So, I mean, the United Nations has appointed an expert to investigate the abuses against albinos in the East African region. Is your government going to cooperate with that investigation when it comes?
That investigation is welcome from that point of view or from that angle, because we believe as government that the fight against the attackers of albinos is not a one-man job. It needs a multi-sectoral approach.
Malawi Information Minister Kondwani Nakumua was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Thousands of people in sub-Saharan Africa die or are disabled each year due to poisonous snake bites. Scientists in Britain are working to develop a serum that will counteract the venom from all sub-Saharan poisonous snake bites. Viewer George Putish reports.
The puff adder is only one of many venomous snakes native to sub-Saharan Africa. Dr. Robert Harrison of the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine says every year puff adders and the other snakes kill about 32,000 people.
It's not only that. Other people who survive the bite, about 100,000 of them, are living with severe disabled limbs or legs, just really very, very disabling conditions.
The current method of producing anti-venom, starting with the venom itself, is time-consuming and costly, and the serum must be refrigerated. Victims have to be treated multiple times, and there are possible side effects. With the price of about $140 per single dose, the full treatment may cost more than $500, which makes it unaffordable for most rural Africans. In addition, because of the way they're produced, current serums counteract poison from only one species or a few related ones, so doctors must determine what snake bit the victim. The anti-venom developed by scientists at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, specifically for Nigeria, proved to be cheap, safe, and effective. Dr. Harrison says his team is using it as a basis for developing universal anti-venom applicable to all venomous snakes in sub-Saharan Africa.
We're going to do that by identifying the proteins that are unique to all the other species and taking these unique proteins, i.e. different from the source-scale viper, the puff adder, or the spitting cobra, and add that to the venoms from the original three.
For this purpose, the lab is regularly extracting venom from 450 snakes belonging to 21 of the most deadly species of sub-Saharan African snakes. Scientists say the universal antivenom will be more affordable than current serums and will be effective much longer. Target date for the ultimate test after a year of storage at room temperature is set for July 2018. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Dikembe Mutombo is among 11 former American professional NBA players to be inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame between the 10th and 12th of September in Springfield, Massachusetts State in the United States of America, American media reports revealed on Monday. Mutombo played in the NBA between 1991 and 2009 for the Denver Nuggets, Atlanta Hawks, Philadelphia 76ers, New Jersey Nets, New York Knicks, and Houston Rockets. His NBA playing accolades include being an 8-time NBA All-Star and a 4-time NBA Defensive Player of the Year. He is famous for wagging his finger after successfully blocking a shot. An alumni of Georgetown University in the United States capital, Washington, D.C., Mutombo has worked on several humanitarian projects. His most outstanding project is the construction of the US dollars, $29,300,000 Diamba Marie Mutombo Hospital on the outskirts of the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. Opened in 2007, he named the hospital after his mother, who passed away following a stroke in 1997. In football, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, is to confer its Platinum Order of Merit Award on the Africa Union Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma during its General Assembly meeting in Cairo, Egypt today, Tuesday. CAF is honoring Dlamini Zuma for her contribution since assuming office in June 2012, where the AU has partnered CAF in significant social responsibility initiatives, particularly in the fight against AIDS, Ebola, malaria, and the promotion of education and a culture of peace in Africa. Dlamini Zuma is the second recipient of CAF's highest accolade after the Equatorial Guinea president Teodoro Obiang Nguema, who received the award at the opening ceremony of the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Malabo in January. Staying in Cairo, the Confederation of African Football will award posthumously the Order of Merit Gold Label to Tunisia's Slim Alulu today, Tuesday. Alulu, who passed away in January, was elected onto the CAF executive in 1988. Alulu was a key legal advisor to African football, CAF President Issa Hayatou revealed in Cairo. The Gold Order of Merit will be presented to his widow Zainab Alulu. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Kenyan warplanes have attacked targets in neighboring Somalia days after gunmen from Somali, the militant group Al-Shabaab, killed 148 people at a Kenyan university. And that is it for this Tuesday, April 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Marco Ouma, along with our engineer Zara Abuze, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa with host Shaka Sali. Good Luck Jonathan loses, but democracy wins in Nigeria. We'll look across Africa at the system of government where power is vested in the people. That's next, right here on VOA Africa.
African music mix.
Every
everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.